Maybe this was where they kept their vehicles. But where were the satellite dishes? Were they around the back? Or was I doing a recce on the local beetroot boiling factory? And where would they have banged up Tom? What now? I had the same problem as at Microsoft HQ. Too much virgin snow and not enough time. It would have been great to have been able to do a full 360 of this place, but tough I couldn't. I even wondered about trying to climb up the outside of the hangar funnel to get a better look around. But even if there was a climbing rail attached to it, I was likely to leave sight on the roof or on the rungs. And anyway, what would I see at that distance? I lay there and reminded myself that when you were short of the two most important commodities, time and knowledge, sometimes the only answer on targets is P for plenty of explosives. I stayed where I was, visualizing how to defeat the wall and get in on target, going through a mental checklist of the kit I'd be needing. Some of the stuff would have to come from 8, because it would be impossible for me to access it on my own in the time available. If 8 couldn't get it, plan B would have to be to tie a suicide bandana around my head and bang on the gates, making really rude threats. I might as well. Anything else but P for plenty of explosives would be futile, given the timescale. The rest of the kit I would get myself to make sure it was exactly right. I hated depending on other people, but when in Chad... The cold was getting to me and I was starting to freeze. I'd seen all I was going to see tonight. Being careful not to disturb the snow on either side of the tire ruts, I got up, checking with my hands that I hadn't dropped anything. It was just habit, but a good one. Then I slowly checked the snow on either side of the rut as I moved back to the road, getting ready to play repairman. If any sign did need covering up, I would have to collect snow from the area around the car and carry it over. Detail counts. There would be no point in picking up snow from near the repair and just creating more sign. I'd warmed up quite a bit by the time I got back to the larder. Unfortunately, the first thing I had to do after lifting the bonnet was take off my jacket and ram it down onto the starter motor. I didn't want Tom's new friends to hear me when I battered it with the hammer. Ripping the newspaper from behind the windscreen wipers, I got into the driving seat quicker than last time, now knowing how to play the door lock. The engine fired third time. Keeping the revs low, I drove away, not going past the target this time, but taking a few lefts instead to try and box round and get back on the main drag to Narva. I got lost a couple of times, but eventually found it and rejoined the death race. Chapter 34. I parked up once more in the border crossing car park. It was 9:24, according to Lion King. There was no way I was going to drive straight to 8's place. I wanted to check out the area first, just in case Carpenter had returned. If so, I would have to spend the night hanging around, waiting for him to leave again. I locked up the car and headed back to the bar, hands in pockets, head down. Approaching from the direction of the burned-out shed, I could see the BM hadn't returned, and only two of the other vehicles were still there, both now covered in thick ice. It was one of the Cherokee Jeeps that was missing. What did that mean? Fuck it. I had no time to mess about. When would be the right time to enter the house? I'd just take my chances and go for it. All I wanted was to get the kit together and make some money as soon as possible. I pressed the intercom button and waited, but got no answer. I pressed it again. A crackling male voice answered, not the same one as before, but just as rough. I knew the routine now and even a little Russian. Vorsim! Vorsim! The static stopped, but I knew to wait, even moving out of the way after a minute or two for the main door to open. Soon bolts were being pulled on the inside. The door swung open, and there stood 8, still in his red sweatshirt. As he unlocked the grill, he peered anxiously out into the car park. My wheels? I walked in and waited as he locked up behind, still frantically scanning the car park. The car's fine. Is the guy with the BMW coming back? He shrugged his shoulders as I started to climb the stairs behind him. You'll need a pen and paper, Vorsim.
But what about my wheels?
I still hadn't answered when we entered the third floor room. With no natural light, the TV room was much darker, but it still smelled the same, heavy with cigarette smoke. No one was here. Nothing had changed apart from the fact that next to the plastic-coated playing cards on the table, there was now a lamp, dimly glinting on the Johnny Walker bottle, which was three-quarters empty. Three ashtrays were full and spilling dog ends on the once highly polished table. The TV was still on, throwing bursts of light around the other side of the room. Through a snow lens, I could see Kirk Douglas playing a cowboy with the volume down low. I could just hear the dialogue.
"Yo, Nick, the table."
He pointed at several cheap biros and sheets of lined A4 paper scattered amongst the crap. Some had tally marks on. I sat down and started to write a list, wondering if the marks were card game scores or a record of today's deals. Eight pulled up a chair opposite me.
"Come on, you play. Where's the car, man?"
"Down the road." He searched my face.
"It's okay?"
"Yeah, yeah. Just let me finish this." I wanted this kit organized and to get the fuck out of there as quickly as I could. "Where is everybody?" He moved his arms around like a breakdancer on Fast Forward.
"Business. You know, my man. Business."
I finished writing and pushed the sheet of paper over to him. He looked at it and didn't appear fazed. I was expecting knots of sucking through teeth, but the only question I got was,
"8 kilos?
"Yeah, 8 kilos. They certainly weren't the sort of kilos he normally dealt with.
8 kilos of what, Nikolai?"
His shoulders went up and his face went down. It was obvious he didn't understand anything I'd written apart from 8 kilograms. He'd learned to speak English from the TV, but he couldn't read it. Maybe he should have spent more time watching Sesame Street and a bit less watching NYPD Blue. "Shall I just say what I need and you write it down?" I didn't want to embarrass him, and besides, anything to speed this up. He smiled now there was a way out.
"Telling me would be cool, yeah."
Halfway through dictating the list, I had to explain what a detonator was. A few minutes later, when he'd stopped holding the pen in his fist like a child and his tongue was back in his mouth, he looked very pleased with himself.
"Okay, cool."
He jumped out of his seat, studying his handiwork and feeling very important.
"Wait here, Nikolai, my man."
He disappeared through the door near the fireplace. A few seconds later, I heard a much older voice roaring with laughter. I wasn't sure if that was good or bad. I didn't try to see who it was. If it was the older voice who decided whether I could have it, then spying on him while he made that decision wasn't going to change anything, apart from pissing him off and making my life more difficult than it already was. The sound of footsteps echoed from the stairwell, accompanied by volleys of quick, aggressive talking, slowly getting louder as people came up the stairs. I told myself not to worry, even though my heartbeat quickened as I listened for Carpenter. As the voices got louder, I still couldn't work out whether they were pissed off or that was just the way they talked. The door burst open, and I watched as the Goodfellas came in one by one, ready to grip Johnny Walker and use him over someone's head. There was no Carpenter. It was the same 4 card players, taking off their leather jackets and hats. The old one, carrier bag in hand, kept on his silver-grey fur Cossack-style number. I stayed put, my heart beating even quicker with relief as I screwed up the first list and put it in my pocket. They crossed the room towards me without any acknowledgement, except from the fur-hatted older one, who shouted and waved the back of his hand at me to get the fuck out of his chair and away from the table. I got up and moved, no skin off my nose. I was there for other things, not to get macho. From the window I watched the traffic queuing at the checkpoint. It looked even more like a movie scene now that floodlights were soaking the area in a brilliant white glow. The same couldn't be said for the lighting this side of the river. All 4 were now sat at the table, pouring the last of the whiskey and lighting up. There was a lot of talk from them, which drowned out the low-volume gunfight Kirk was winning on the opposite side of the room. The old guy pulled packets of sausage and dark rye bread from the carrier bag and threw them onto the table, while the others tore open the plastic protection around the sliced meat and ripped off lumps of bread. I watched, feeling a bit hungry myself, but I didn't imagine I'd be on the guest list. It became obvious, as heads nodded in my direction, mixed with quick glances, that I was the subject of conversation. One of the boys said something, and they all looked over. There was a little joke said and a few snickers. Then it all got serious again as they got back to eating. I kept pretending to look out of the window and be unaware of what was going on behind me. A chair scraped on the bare wooden floor, and shoes echoed on the boards as one of them came towards me. I turned and smiled at the old guy in his hat, watching as the TV shone on him in the gloom when he passed the screen. He was facing me, but talking back to the others, looking very serious. This wasn't another piss take. An index finger started pointing at me as he got closer, as if to reinforce whatever he was gobbing off about. I looked down in submission and slightly turned back towards the window. From less than a foot away, he began to poke me in the back, shouting very close to my head. I turned and looked at him, confused and frightened, then looked down, just like Tom would have. I smelled garlic and alcohol, and as he continued to rant and poke, flecks of sausage hit my face. His face, creased and leathered and showing a day's stubble, was now no more than a few inches away as the fur from his hat brushed against my forehead. He bellowed at me again. I wasn't going to react by moving or wiping away his shit from my face. It might antagonize him even more. I just stood and let him get on with it, just like I'd done at school when teachers went ballistic. I was never scared. I knew they would finish or get bored with it quickly. So fuck 'em. Let them get on with their fun so I could bunk school straight afterwards. It was one of the attitudes that had fucked up my life. I moved my left hand to the window and supported myself as I was getting the forefinger poke now, my body jerking back with each jab. Glancing across, I could see the other three at the table, their cigarettes glowing in the semi-darkness, enjoying the cabaret. The shouting and bad breath continued. Sounding as frightened as I could, I stammered, "I am here for eight, Vorsim." He mocked me.
Vorsim.
Turning towards the table, he mimed injecting his arm, laughing along with the other three. He turned back and gave me one last shove against the window. I took it and then steadied myself as he headed back for more garlic sausage. He was obviously talking about me as he pretended to take a line from his index finger to the accompaniment of further laughter. Let them think it. The drama was over. Now, where the fuck was eight? I looked out of the window again, slowly wiping all the shit off my face as the floorboards echoed towards me once more. He was coming back for seconds. He got right up on me again and gave me a push with both hands. He was fucking with me. He was having some fun, maybe taking out some frustration. The others laughed as I rode the pushes and tried to lean against the window frame, still showing no resistance, looking forlornly at the floor to appear even less of a threat. He got more serious with each push, and I began to get pissed off. After one particularly hard one, I stumbled backwards towards the television. He followed me, the pushes now punctuated with the odd slap round the head. I kept my face down, not wanting him to see in my eyes what I was really thinking. He kept repeating the same word over and over, then he started gesturing, rubbing fingers and pointing at my boots. Did he want my money and Timberlands? Money I could understand, but boots? This was getting out of control. If I was right, he would be getting a lot more than he bargained for if my boots came off. I couldn't let that happen. I held my hands up in submission.
Stop! Stop! Stop!
He did, and waited for his cash. I slowly reached into the inside pocket of the jacket and pulled out the insurance policy, still inside its protection. He looked at the condom and then at me, his eyes narrowing. Untying the knot at the end, I probed inside with two fingers. He barked a question at me, then, shouting something at the others, he grabbed the condom and roughly fished inside. Opening the thin paper and partly tearing it in the process, he turned to the table and waved it at them, as if sharing the joke in a Christmas cracker. Bending down into the lights given off by Kirk on his horse, he pushed the note in front of the screen. His laughter subsided as he started to read. Then it stopped completely. Whatever the bit of paper said, it was doing the business. He walked over to the others, looking extremely pissed off as he muttered, "Ignati! Ignati!" I hadn't a clue what that meant, and I didn't really care. They all had a read, and it had the same effect on everyone. They slowly turned their heads and stared at me across the room. I brought my hands together in front of me, not wanting to appear a threat. It was good the policy had worked, but it meant I might have to put up with their loss of face. Some people have the fuck-it factor when this sort of thing happens, and regardless of the possible fallout, they'll still retaliate because their pride has been hurt. I couldn't afford to fuel that by appearing at all cocky. I still wasn't out of the woods. Walking over to the table, my face full of respect, I put out my left hand, making sure that Lion King wasn't exposed. It wouldn't exactly help me maintain my new standing. I nodded at the sheet of paper. "Please." He may not have understood the word, but he knew what it meant. He handed it back, hating every second of it, and I folded it carefully and put it in my pocket. Now wasn't the time to start putting it back into a condom. "Thank you." I gave a little bow of the head and, with my heart pumping as hard as if it was forcing crude oil through my arteries, I turned my back to them and walked to the TV. Sitting as casually as I could in the chair facing the screen, I watched Kirk still taming the Wild West, leaning forward to hear what was happening out there in the desert. My pulse was louder than the TV. I could tell that once I was out of earshot, there was going to be some very loud shouting. But for now, there was just low, disgruntled murmuring behind me. Where the fuck was 8? Not wanting to turn or look in any other direction than the screen, I sat like a child who thinks he can't be seen at bedtime if he just concentrates hard and doesn't move. They carried on mumbling as glasses were banged with the neck of the whiskey bottle to drown their anger. My eyes were on the screen and my ears were on them. 5 minutes later, just as Kirk was about to save the girl, 8 came back into the room. I didn't understand what he was saying as he fought with a zip on his leatherette jacket, but by the look of it, we were leaving. Muttering a silent prayer of thanks, I got to my feet and tried not to show my relief. As 8 went to the door, and I passed the table, they got a respectful bow from me before I followed him downstairs at the speed of sound. Chapter 35. 8 was a happy teddy the moment he caught sight of his beloved larder in the noisy car park. "Where do we go now, Vorsim?"
"A block."
He already had the larder's bonnet open.
"A block? You know, an apartment."
I heard two metallic bangs as the starter motor got a reminder as to what it did for a living. The larder eventually fired up, and he drove us both out of the car park and turned right towards the roundabout. The Comfort bars all had enormous doormen standing under their flashing neon to control the evening's trade. Turning left this time at the roundabout, away from the river, we drove past even more establishments and parked trucks. The bar's lights slowly disappeared, and the darkness took over again. Now apartment blocks and industrial buildings lined the road, in between pylons and shells of crumbling masonry. Fighting with two trucks that were trying to overtake each other, both throwing up waves of ice and snow, we turned left without indicating. Then left again down a narrow street, with apartments to the left and a tall wall to the right. 8 threw the larder into the side of the road and jumped out.
"Wait here, my man."
Skirting the inevitable pylon leg, he headed for the main door of one of the blocks. He stopped and checked the stenciling, gave me the thumbs up, then turned back towards the larder to lock up. I got out and waited. The loud, constant noise of machinery came from behind the wall as I entered a very cold, dimly lit hallway. So narrow I could easily have put my arms out and touched both walls. It stank of boiled cabbage. Tiles were missing from the floor, and the walls were painted blue, apart from the places where big chunks of plaster had fallen to the ground. Nobody had bothered to sweep them up. The apartment doors, which were one-piece sheet metal with three locks and a spy hole, looked so low that you'd have to stoop when entering. We waited for the lift by rows of wooden letterboxes. Most of the doors had been ripped from their hinges, and the others were just left open. I'd have felt more comfortable walking into a South American jail. The wall by the lift was covered with a mass of hand-painted instructions, all in Russian. He gave me something to look at while we listened to the motor groaning inside the shaft. The machinery stopped with a loud shudder, and the doors opened. We entered an aluminium box. Its panelling dented everywhere it was possible for boots to have connected. It reeked of urine. 8 hit the button for the fourth floor and we lurched upwards, the lift stopping suddenly every few feet, then starting again, as if it had forgotten where to go. Eventually, we reached the fourth floor and the doors opened into semi-darkness. I let him step out ahead of me. Turning left, 8 stumbled, and as I followed, I found out why. A young kid was curled up on the floor. As the doors slammed shut again, cutting out even more of the dim light, I bent down to examine his small body, bulked out by 2 or 3 badly knitted jumpers. By his head lay 2 empty crisp packets, and thick, dried snot hung from his nostrils to his mouth. He was breathing, and he wasn't bleeding, but even in the feeble light from the ceiling bulb, it was obvious that he was in shit state. Zits covered the area around his mouth, and saliva dribbled from his lips. He was about the same age as Kelly. I suddenly thought of her, and felt a surge of emotion. As long as I was around, she would never be exposed to this kind of shit. As long as I was around. I could see the expression on Dr. Hughes's face. 8 looked down at the boy with total disinterest. He kicked the bags, turned away and carried on walking. I dragged the local gluehead out of the way of the lift and followed. We turned left along a corridor, 8 singing some Russian rap song and pulling a string of keys from his jacket. Reaching the door right at the end, he messed about, trying to work out which key went where until finally it opened, then groping for the light switch. The room we entered definitely wasn't the source of the boiled cabbage stench. I could smell the heavy odor of wooden crates and gun oil. I would have known that smell anywhere. Proust's mate's childhood might have rushed back to him when he caught a whiff of Madeleine cakes. This one took me straight back to the age of 16 and the very first day I joined the army as a boy soldier in 76. Cakes would have been better. The inevitable single bulb lit up a very small hall, no more than a couple of meters square. There were 2 doors leading off. 8 went through the one on the left and I followed, closing the front door behind me and throwing all the locks. Only 1 of the 4 bulbs worked in a ceiling cluster that any 1960s family would have been proud of. The small room was stacked with wooden crates, waxed cardboard boxes, and loose explosive ordnance, all stenciled with Cyrillic script. The whole lot looked very Chad. Chad that was dangerously past its use-by date. Nearest to me was a stack of brown wooden boxes with rope handles. Lifting the lid off the top one, I recognized the dull, green bedpan shapes at once. 8, grinning from ear to ear, made the noise of an explosion, his hands flying everywhere. He seemed to know they were landmines too.
"See, my man? I get what you want. Guarantee your satisfaction, yes?"
I just nodded as I looked around some more. Piles of other kit lay wrapped in brown military greaseproof paper. Elsewhere, damp cardboard boxes stacked on top of each other had collapsed, spilling their contents onto the floorboards. Lying in a corner were half a dozen electric detonators, aluminium tubes about the size of a quarter smoked cigarette, with two 18-inch silver wire leads coming out of one end. The silver leads were loose, not twisted together, which was frightening stuff. It meant they were ready to act as antennae for any stray extraneous electricity, a radio wave, say, or energy from a mobile phone, to set them off, and probably all the rest of the shit in there too. This place was a nightmare. It seemed the Russians hadn't been too fussed about where this kind of stuff ended up in the early 90s. Picking up the detonators one by one, I twisted the leads together to close the circuit, then mooched around the rest of the kit, ripping open cardboard boxes. Eight did the same, either to make me think he knew what he was doing or just out of curiosity. I gripped his arm and shook my head, not wanting him to play with anything. It would be nice to get out of here with all my bits and without him losing any more fingers. He looked hurt, so once I'd finished sorting the debts out and had stored them in an empty ammo box, I pulled out the policy to give him something to do. "What does this say, Vorsim?" I presumed he could read his own language. As he moved under the light, I spotted some dark green debt cord. It wasn't in its handy 200-meter reel as I would have liked. There seemed to be 2 meters here, another 10 meters there. But then I saw a partly used reel with maybe 80 or 90 meters left, which would certainly do the trick. I put the reel of debt cord to one side and went to check the other rooms. That was easy enough, because each was about the size of a broom cupboard. There was a tiny kitchen-cum-bathroom-cum-toilet arrangement, and a bedroom that was even smaller. What I was looking for was plastic explosive, but there wasn't any. The only PE around here was in the anti-tank mines, and there were certainly enough of those to give me pee for plenty. I returned to the main room, and lifted one of them from the open box. These were either TM-40s or 46s. I could never remember which was which. All I knew was that one was made of metal and the other of plastic. These ones were metal, about a foot in diameter and weighed around 20 pounds, of which over 12 pounds was PE. They were shaped like old-fashioned brass bed warmers, the sort that hang on stone fireplaces, alongside the horse brasses in country pubs. Instead of the long broomstick, these things had a swiveling carry handle, like on the side of a mess tin. It was going to be a pain in the arse to get the PE out of these things, but what was I expecting? Placing the mine on the bare floorboards, I tried to unscrew the cap, which was in the center of the top. Before laying it, all you had to do was replace the cap with a detonation device, normally a fuse and detonator combination. Then, stand well back and wait for a tank. When it eventually started to move, shifting the years of grime that had formed a seal, I knew at once that it was really old ordnance. The smell of marzipan hit my nostrils. The greenish explosive had become obsolete in recent years. It still worked, it did the job. But the nitroglycerin fucked up not only armor, but also the head and skin of anyone preparing it. You were guaranteed a fearsome headache if you worked with it in a confined space, and extreme pain if you got it on a cut. I was taking enough aspirin already without having to deal with that. Eight sparked up.
"Hey, Nikolai, this paper is really cool."
"What does it say?"
"First of all, his name is Ignati. Then it says you are his man. Whatever you need must be yours. He protects you, my man."
He looked at me.
"It gets heavy. It says, if you do not help my friend, I will kill your wife, and then, after you have been crying for 2 weeks, I will kill your children. 2 weeks after that, I will kill you. That's heavy shit, my man."
"Who is Ignati?" He gave a shrug.
"He's your guy. Am I right?"
No, he wasn't. He was Val's. The card players had certainly recognized the name. That was for sure. I took the policy from Eight's hands and put it back in my jacket pocket. Now I knew what Liv meant about Tom receiving the kind of threat that made the Brits look a bit weak by comparison. No wonder he'd kept his mouth shut and just done his time. Between us, we carried several boxes down to the car,
passing the kid still lying where I'd left him. On the last trip down, 8 locked up the flat, and we stood by the larder with the hum and groan of the factory in the background. He was going to walk from there, as he wanted to go and see a friend. I said goodbye, feeling more than a bit sorry for him. Like everything else in this place, he too was just fucked over. Thanks a lot, mate. And I'll bring the car back in about 2 days. I shook his cold hand, and then grabbed the door handle as he walked away. He called after me.
Yo, Nikolai, hey.
There was suddenly a less confident tone in his voice.
Can I come to England with you?
I didn't look back, just wanting to get on my way. Why?
I can work for you. My English is cool.
I could hear him getting closer.
Let me go with you, man. Everything will be cool. I want to go to England, and then I will go to America.
Tell you what, I'll be back soon, and we'll talk about it, okay?
When?
Like I said, 2 days. He shook my hand again with all the fingers he had left.
Cool. I'll see you soon, Nikolai. It'll be cool. I will sell my car and get new clothes.
He virtually skipped back up the road, waving at me, thinking about his new life as I gave the starter motor a bit of a hammer, fired it up, and did a 3-point turn to back out onto the main, passing 8 on the way. I'd only driven 100 meters when I stopped and put the car in reverse. Fuck it. I couldn't do this. As I drew alongside and wound down the window, he greeted me with a big smile.
What's up, my man?
I'm sorry, Vorsim. I can't take you. I corrected myself. Will not take you to England. His shoulders and face slumped.
Why not, man? Why not? You just said, man.
I felt an asshole. They won't let you in. You're Russian. You need visas and all that stuff. And even if they do, you won't be able to stay with me. I don't have a house, and I haven't got any work I can give you. I'm really sorry, but I can't and I won't do it. That's it, mate. I'll drop the car off in 2 days. And that was it. I wound the window up and headed back into the center of town, so I knew where I was and could pick up the main Narva Tallinn drag again. I could have lied to him, but I remembered as a kid all the trips that my parents were going to take me on, all the presents I was going to be given, all the promises of nice holidays and all the rest of the shit that had never happened. It was just said to keep me quiet. I couldn't have let 8 get all sparked up, burning bridges and all for nothing. Liv was right. Sometimes it's better to fuck people off with the truth. I found my bearings in town and headed west. My destination was a hotel room where I could prepare all the shit I had in the boot. I was still feeling quite sorry for 8. Not for dumping him, because I knew it was the right thing to do, but because of what the future held for him. Absolute jack shit. A filling station appeared, exactly the same as the one in Tallinn. Very blue, and as clean, bright, and out of place as an alien spacecraft. I pulled in and filled up. Parking off to one side of the building, I went to pay just as the 2 staff had started to think they had their first runner of the night. I was the only customer they had. There was a small section in their shop that actually sold bits and pieces for cars. The rest of the space was given over to beer, chocolate, and sausages. I picked up 5 blue nylon tow ropes, their entire stock, and all 8 rolls of black insulation tape on display, together with a cheap multi-tooled set that would probably break the second time it was used. Finally, I picked up a torch and 2 sets of batteries, and 2 of the small rectangular ones with terminals on top. I couldn't think of anything else I needed just now, apart from some chocolate and meat and a couple of cans of fizzy orange. The guy who took my money had more zits on his head than brain cells in it. He was trying to work out the change, even though the register had told him. Eventually he handed me my carrier bags. I wanted some more and pointed.
More? More?
It took a few seconds of miming and a couple of small coins, but I came out with half a dozen spares. It was sausage and chocolate time. I sat in the car with the engine running, filling my face as I looked out at the main drag. Beyond it was a massive poster site, covering the whole side of a building. Mr. Bean was grinning at me like a Mormon, showing me the wonders of Fujifilm as the trucks screamed past. I didn't blame them. I was in a hurry to get out of town too. Feeling sick after eating everything I'd bought, I rejoined the mayhem on the road. My destination was Boka, a coastal town to the north between Narva and Kotlajärvi, where I was going to prepare for the attack tomorrow afternoon. I had chosen Boka for no other reason than that I liked the name, and that, since it was on the coast, there was probably a better chance of finding a room. Chapter 36 Boka turned out to be just what I was expecting, a small seaside resort with one main drag. Maybe it had been a bit of a hotspot during the Soviet era, but from what I could see of it in my headlights and the occasional functioning streetlight, it was now very tired and flaky. The Estonian equivalent of those Victorian seaside places in Britain that reached their sell-by dates in the 70s, when everyone started getting on planes to Benidorm. When the Russians had packed their bags a few years earlier, this place, too, must have rolled over and died. There was no one about. Everyone was probably at home watching the end of another Kirk Douglas movie. I drove slowly along the coast road with the Baltic on my left and the car rocking with the wind off the sea. There weren't many lights on in the apartments to my right, just the glow now and then of a TV. Eventually, I found a hotelie with a sea view. At first glance, it had looked more like a four-story apartment block until I saw the small, flickering neon sign to the left of its double glass doors. As I locked the larder, waves crashed onto whatever sort of beach was behind me, and the wind buffeted my jacket and hair. The fluorescent lights in the hallway nearly blinded me. It was like walking into a television studio, and almost as hot. A TV blared away somewhere in Russian. I was starting to catch the intonation quite well. The sound came from in front of me. I walked along the corridor until I found its source. At the bottom of a flight of stairs, a sliding window was set chest high into the wall. Behind it sat an old woman, glued to the screen of an old black-and-white TV. There was plenty of time to study her while trying to attract her attention. She wore thick woolen tights and slippers, a chunky black cardigan, a gaudy flowery dress and crocheted woolen hat. While she watched the TV, she spooned lumpy soup out of what looked like a large salad bowl. The TV had a coat hanger for an aerial. That seemed to be the law round here. It reminded me of the times I had to dance around the room with an indoor aerial in my hand so my stepdad could follow the horse racing. No wonder I never got to watch Blue Peter. She finally noticed me, but didn't bother with a greeting or asking what I wanted. Nodding politely and smiling, I pointed at a sheet of paper taped to the window, which I presumed was the tariff. "Can I have a room, please?" I asked in my favourite Australian accent. I was getting rather fond of my Crocodile Dundee impression. It was wasted on her. There was a clatter of footsteps from the wooden staircase, and a couple appeared, both dressed in long overcoats. He was a small, skinny guy in his late 40s, slightly balding on top, but with the rest of his hair greased back in the style that Eastern Europeans, for some reason, think looks marvellous, and a big, droopy moustache. They walked past without giving me or the old woman a second glance. The woman, I noticed, was at least 20 years younger than Baldy, and considerably less smelly. He had a body odour that no deodorant could tame. The old woman handed me a towel the size of a tea cloth and a set of what had once been white sheets. Muttering something, she held one finger in the air, then two. I guessed she meant number of nights. I showed her one. She nodded, writing down some numbers which I took to be the price. Eek, $150 for the night. About $10. A bargain. I couldn't wait to see the room. I gave her the money and she put the key, attached to a 6-inch length of 4x2, on top of the sheets and got back to her soup and TV. I didn't get to learn the Estonian for have a nice day. I walked up the stairs and found room 4. It was bigger than I'd expected, but every bit as drab. There was a dark veneered chipboard wardrobe, 3 brown furry nylon blankets on the stained, multicoloured mattress, and a pair of old, saliva-stained pillows. I was surprised to find a small fridge in the corner. When I checked, I found it wasn't plugged in, but it was still probably worth an extra star from the Estonian tourist board. Next to it, sitting on a brown veneered table, was a 70s-style TV, also unplugged. The carpet was made up of 2 different colours, of hard-wearing, office-type stuff, in dark brown and what might once have been cream. The wallpaper was bubbling in places, with brown, damp stains rounding off the decor. But the pièce de résistance was a cushioned corner unit and coffee table, set off by a large, triangular, thick glass ashtray that any pub would be proud of. The beige nylon seating was heavily soiled, and the coffee table had cigarette burns all around the edge. The room was cold, and it was obviously up to the guest to put the heaters on. To the right of the main door was the bathroom. I'd check that out later. First, I bent over one of the 2 electric fires. It was a small, square 3-bar thing on the door side of the bed. Plugging it in, I threw the switch and the elements started to heat up, filling the air with the acrid smell of burning dust. The second heater, nearer the window, was a more elaborate, decorative model with 2 long bars and above that, a black plastic log effect with a red background. I hadn't seen one since I was at my auntie's house, aged about 7. I plugged it in too, and watched as its red bulb lit up beneath the plastic and the disc started to spin above it to provide a flame effect. It was almost better than the TV. I went into the bathroom. Its walls and floor were tiled, mostly brown, but others, blues and reds, had replaced some of the broken ones in the days when broken ones were replaced. The management's policy had evidently changed in recent years. There was another 2-bar electric fire on the wall above the bath, as well as an ancient, oval-shaped gas geyser with a visible pilot light and a long steel tap which swiveled so you could fill either the bath or the sink. I was expecting the worst, but when I turned the tap on, the pilot lights became a raging flame, with sound effects to match. I was jealous. I wanted one in my house. The water was instantly hot, which was good news. I'd be needing a lot of that soon. Turning it off, I went back into the bedroom, where the fires were starting to do their stuff. Pulling the netting aside, I had a look out to sea. I couldn't see a thing except snow swirling in the light spilling from the window. I closed the curtains and went down to unload the car, starting with 2 mines in a box and the bits and pieces from the gas station. The old woman never looked up once as I came and went, either because she knew better than to inquire into a punter's business, or because she was genuinely gripped by the dubbed version of the 60s Batman TV series. Once back in the room, I started running the bath, slowing the flow to a steamy trickle. I used a screwdriver from the multi-tool set to help remove the 2 mine caps and could smell the green PE the moment the first came off. Holding each mine in turn under the tap until it filled with hot water, I then lowered them into the bath, still letting the water run so that it would eventually cover them. Then I went down to the car and collected another 2. They were heavy, and I didn't want the drama of dropping one. It took 3 trips in all to get everything upstairs. On the final trip, I took another newspaper from the back seat and covered the windscreen. I kept unscrewing mine caps until all 6 were in the bath in 2 layers, representing a total of over 70 pounds of PE. Molten explosive would have been injected into the dull green casings at the factory and left to set to an almost plastic state. I'd have to wait for the hot water to soften it again before I could scrape it out. Back in the bedroom, I turned on the television in time to see Batman and Robin tied together in a giant coffee cup, an animated American voiceover telling me I'd have to wait until next week for the next exciting installment, followed by the Russian translation, which said they really couldn't give a fuck what happened. I got hold of the reel of debt cord, which looked just like a green washing line, except that instead of string inside the plastic covering, there was high explosive. This stuff would have the job of initiating the two charges I was going to construct with the PE once I'd got it out of the mines. I cut off about the first foot of cord with my Leatherman. It was probable that the explosive core had been affected by the climatic conditions and or age. But if so, the contamination normally wouldn't have penetrated further than 6 inches. The reel then went to the window side of the bed. Only prepared kit would go this side from now on. That way, things wouldn't get confusing as I became more tired. Without any announcement, Charlie's Angels suddenly burst onto the screen. I hoped it was the series with Cheryl Ladd. Farrah Fawcett never did it for me when I was a kid. As the monotone Russian translation started up, I went back into the bathroom. The water level still had a way to go as the steaming water trickled out of the geyser. Time to check the batteries. They were normal rectangular 9-volt ones with press stud tops for the positive and negative terminals, the sort that are used in portable radios or toys. One of them would be the initiation device, providing the electrical charge that would run along the firing cable, which I still had to obtain. It would then initiate the detonator, which would fire up the det cord and, in turn, the charges. All this could only happen if the power from the battery was strong enough to overcome the resistance from the firing cable and det. You attach the firing cable to a torch bulb. If it lights up when you transmit power along the length of firing cable, you've got enough juice to make the thing go bang. It was getting warm enough to take my jacket off now. I took the insurance policy out of the inside pocket. It was looking a bit the worse for wear. So I folded it neatly, fished around for the condom, and stuck it into the small key pocket on the front right-hand side of my jeans. Next, I pulled the plug off the bedside lamp and ripped the other end of the flex out of the lamp base, ending up with about 5 feet of firing cable. Not enough. I needed to be close to the explosion, but 5 feet was suicidally close. The fridge flex gave me another 5. The bath ought to have been almost full by now. I went and checked just as Charlie's Angels, dressed up as old women but still looking very glamorous and without a hair out of place, were about to infiltrate an old people's home on some secret mission. All the mines were covered with hot water, so I turned off the tap on the geyser. I couldn't see a toilet brush anywhere, but there was a rubber plunger. Using its handle to prod the PE in one of the mines, I found it was still too hard. Footsteps in the corridor signaled that the hotel had some new guests. There was a female giggle and lusty Russian male talk as they passed. Then I heard the door next to mine bang shut. Stretched out on the bed watching Charlie's Angels free the world of evil, I connected the two lengths of flex and taped them up. 10 feet of firing cable was still not enough. The trouble was, I wouldn't know how much I needed until I was on target, and I'd have to err on the side of safety. I wished I had about 100 meters of the stuff, but where would I find some at this time of night? Tomorrow would be too late. I wouldn't have enough time to fart about looking for a B&Q. I had to make more of my own. So it was bye-bye, Cheryl. Due to the positioning of the wall sockets, the power line for the TV was quite long. In total, I ended up with about 18 feet of cable. With the TV now off, I could hear the romance developing next door. There were plenty of oohs and ahs, a bit of giggling, and a few slaps on bare flesh. I didn't need the dubbing. I joined the last section of wire together using the Western Union pigtail method. Chinese labourers used it to repair downed telegraph lines in the Wild West. It's basically a reef knot with the tail ends twisted together. It not only guarantees conductivity, but makes it unlikely the connection will get pulled apart. The three lengths were all of different thicknesses and metals, but as long as they conducted electricity, that was all I was worried about. I wrapped the copper wires at one end around the torch bulb and taped it in place. Now all I had to do was complete the circuit with the two steel wires at the other end of the cable on the battery terminals. And bang, perfect. The bulb glowed. I repeated the process with the other battery, and both worked. For now. If they both failed on target and I didn't get detonation, I'd have to switch to Plan B and put on the bandana. Untaping the wire from the bulb, I twisted the two copper wires together. Then the two steel wires at the other end and earthed it against the back of the fridge. That would take away any electricity still in the cable. The last thing I wanted was to connect the wires to a detonator and have the thing explode immediately. That wouldn't be a good day out. The coil of firing cable joined the det cord on the window side of the bed, and I placed the two batteries on top of the TV. You never keep the initiation device with the detonators or the rest of the equipment. The fuck-up factor is never far away, and I wasn't taking any chances. The only time all the equipment should come together is when you're going to detonate the charges. A lesson one or two pyro boys learned the hard way back in the 80s. The foreplay was over next door, and they were getting down to the heavy stuff. Either she was really enjoying it, or she was going for an Oscar as the bed tried to bang itself through the wall and into my bathroom. When I checked the mines, the water in the bath was rippling with the vibrations coming through the wall. There was still a while to go before I could start digging out the PE. To use the time productively, I took a sheet of toilet paper with me, put my jacket back on, and walked out into the corridor. The shagfest reached a rousing crescendo as I placed a small strip of the toilet paper by the bottom hinge and closed the door on it, checking there was just enough paper to be seen. Silence fell next door as I left my neighbours to their cigarettes and Charlie's Angels and headed for the stairs. The old woman was still glued to her TV. Frozen air clawed at my lungs as I peeled the newspaper off the larder's windscreen. The engine turned over sluggishly after I'd zapped the starter motor, but eventually it sparked up. I knew how it felt. Chapter 37. I cruised slowly around town looking for the materials I needed to construct the explosive charges, attacking another four aspirin to sort out the headache that I'd developed after playing with the mines. Spotting a row of skips behind a small parade of shops, I pulled in and sifted through the old bits of cardboard packaging, tins and rags. There was nothing that would do for me, apart from a partly broken wooden pallet resting against the wall. Three sections, each about a meter long, were soon in the back of the car while a dog, cooped up in one of the shops, barked its head off in frustration and not being able to get at me. One section was going to help me get over the wall. The other two were going to prop the charges in place on target. Lights were off, and curtains were drawn as I left the area in search of more stuff, driving through the heavy mist that rolled in from the sea. After 10 minutes of patrolling the ghost town, I saw a building that was worth a closer look. Rubbish was piled up outside it, but it was the structure itself that made me curious. It turned out to be an air raid shelter, built in the days when they were expecting Uncle Sam's hairy-arsed B-52 bombers to come and dump on them big time. There was a concrete stairwell down to below ground level, and a thick metal door which was padlocked. The stairwell was full of wind-blown litter and heavier stuff that had been fly-tipped, and it was in amongst all this that I found some expanded polystyrene packaging. I selected two pieces, each just under a meter square. The corners were higher than the middle, which was contoured to fit the shape of whatever it had been made to protect. Here and there, holes had been punched to save material and give the structure a bit more strength. I now had the frames for the charges. It reminded me of having to make Claymore anti-personnel mines out of ice cream cartons before going into Iraq during the Gulf War. The last item I needed was a brick, and in a place like this, I didn't have to look far for one. Back at the hotel, the old woman had deserted her post and the TV was running what looked like a Russian talk show, with the host and his guests talking at each other very glumly. It looked as though they were trying to decide which one of them should commit suicide first. I walked up the stairs with my finds in my arms, feeling pleased that I had everything.